Good afternoon, New York, and the rest of our listeners around the globe. My name is June Stoyer, and I'm the host of the Organic Food Radio Show. Our podcast is available on iTunes, Zune, and you can also visit our website at www.theorganicview.com. If you have any questions for our guests, there are many ways you can contact the show. You can post your question on our wall on Facebook, Skype us, send us a tweet on Twitter to @TheOrganicView, or you can contact me directly at June Stoyer on Twitter. If you'd like to be on the show or like to find out about sponsorship opportunities, please contact us at questions@TheOrganicView.com. Today marks the anniversary of one of mankind's greatest achievements in history. December 14th is actually South Pole Day. It is the day in which Roald Amundsen reached the South Pole. Now, on today's show, I have the pleasure of welcoming Stephen Bound, who is a preeminent historian. And he is an award-winning author, and he has done a magnificent job telling the tale of a man who has truly inspired so many people, but is not remembered quite that much in recent history. But he's someone that many people are rediscovering, and his whole life and his life's work are inspiring many people to not only reach for the stars, but really go for what matters to them as an individual, as opposed to just doing things because it seems to be something that they're supposed to do as far as what their families expect of them and so on and so forth. And this story is just such an amazing journey to understand how much one man can really lead others into a journey that is not only significant for his own purpose, but something that can actually impact the entire world. So I would like to welcome to the show Stephen Bound. Good afternoon, Stephen, and welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks. It's great to be here.
Stephen, can you tell our audience about yourself and also what inspired you to write The Last Viking?
Well, I mean, I'm a historian and a biographer, but I also have an adventurous side to me. So I live here in the Rocky Mountains, and I love my skiing and my mountain biking and hiking and going on adventures. But I was always, half my life is spent, buried in books and reading all these other adventurers and explorers and everything. I would always come across mentions of Roald Amundsen, especially in relation to the Northwest Passage, that famous waterway in the Arctic where for thousands of years, hundreds of years, I guess, ships from the Arctic, ships from Britain and America were trying to batter their way through the ice-choked channels to find the riches of the Orient and back. And at the end of that story, there's always a... Excuse me. I had a choke there. There's always a little reference to a character, a Norwegian character named Roald Amundsen, who sailed the Northwest Passage between 1905, 1903, and 1906, and basically unlock the mysteries of that channel. But there's not much ever said about him. But you do hear about Roald Amundsen in relation to the South Pole.
And
where
it's
he's
interesting
often presented.
Oh, I'm sorry. I was going to say, it's interesting that today is actually 101 years.
Yeah,
That achievement.
Yeah, and at the South Pole, if you try and think back in time to what the world was like at that time, there was no maps of either the North or the South Pole. All of these regions didn't even feature on a globe of the time. So for someone like Amundsen to set off into the complete unknown and bring back the information of what actually was out there was like a truly incredible feat. But when you read about the South Pole race, there's always Robert Falcon Scott on one hand, as presented as the great heroic British commander, and then there's a dour, humorless Amundsen who's often featured as like a coarse, uncouth taskmaster driving his men to achieve the great victories. But he's often presented as the person who won the race to the South Pole but didn't deserve to do so. And I always thought comparing these two versions of Amundsen, one who's a hero for sailing the Northwest Passage and who had great compassion and understanding for the native peoples in the Arctic and who learned from them all his polar survival techniques. And on the other hand, there's this uncouth, an unpleasant character who rushed to the South Pole and won this race, but really was someone who morally didn't deserve to be there and who maybe cheated. And as a biographer, I sensed that those were two incompatible sides. And, you know, I wanted to find out where the truth lies. And my interest in Amundsen, of course, stems from my own interest in the outdoor world and adventures in the rugged regions of the world and the mountains. But my intellectual interest in Amundsen came from figuring out how these two incompatible views could be reconciled. And I set out to write that in the biography. And, you know, of course, I came to some interesting discoveries.
Now, it's interesting how he began and also just the way that things were back then. I mean, it was expected that you would do certain things in life and basically follow a natural course as everybody else did. And he didn't exactly do that. Can you talk about his upbringing and also his mother's wishes for his future?
Yeah, I mean, he's a very interesting character that way. I mean, he grew up in Norway at a time when Norway was still being governed by Sweden. It was sort of a, you know, second-tier nation that hadn't quite achieved its prominence in the world yet or its independence. And but even though it was a somewhat backward place, Amundsen had a different and unique opening on the world. Through his father, who was a ship captain and a merchant, he was exposed to the outside world and did lots of travel and worked on ships that sailed around the place. So he knew that the outside world exists and other countries and other cultures existed. And yet from his mother, he inherited an interest in books and education, which was lacking in his father. So he combined these two interests, both of which opened up new windows into possibilities for him. And of course, his mother wanted him to become a medical doctor, and that was something that he really had no interest in. He stuck with it for a few years, and then as soon as his mother actually died, he immediately dropped out of university and set himself on a course to becoming an adventurer. And this real interest in discovering the unknown places of the world came to him when he was a teenager, and how would we describe that? It was quite a thing in Norway at that time to be the hero who went off into the world and then returned back with knowledge and riches, or, you know, people could achieve great fame by doing that because it was a smaller country on the world stage. And his compatriot, Amundsen's compatriot, Fridtjof Nansen, had returned several expeditions during Amundsen's youth where Nansen was hailed as a great hero, first for, you know, attempting to sail to the North Pole by wedging a ship in the ice and drifting up there and trying to ski towards it, which he was nearly successful at, and also for trying to be the first person to ski across Greenland. And so when Nansen returned from these journeys, the public came out in their multitudes, and there were cheering, and he was hailed as a great public hero. And Amundsen, of course, you know, being, you know, 14 years old or 16 years old, saw this and said he realized that's the fame that he wanted for himself. And so from that very early age, he had these two windows into the way the world was operating outside of the insular nature of Norway, and he really wanted to achieve the same fame that Nansen had achieved. And he set off on that, you know, that personal journey by deliberately forcing himself into a regimen of physical training and well, I guess you would call it intellectual learning, too. He wanted to not only be the strongest, the fastest, the most tough person that he could possibly imagine himself to be, including sleeping with the window open at night all winter long to toughen himself up. He also read every single book that he could possibly find on all the Arctic adventures, you know, all the Franklin expeditions and all these famous ones from the past century. A lot of it was doomed British expeditions, but he wanted to take from what he could from that, every little bit of knowledge on leadership, how the expeditions were successful, how the expeditions failed, and he just wanted to absorb everything that he possibly could in preparation for his own journey to becoming a great explorer.
Do you think that John Franklin was the one person that really pushed him to pursue this, especially after his mother passed?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, it's very interesting that in one sense, Amundsen wrote in his memoirs much later in life that when he was initially looking at being an explorer, what attracted him most was the great heroic suffering that people like Franklin would endure on their, you know, quasi-successful quests. you know, I guess that would be the romanticism of being a teenager, maybe. Mm. You could, you know, the idea, you know, of upholding on a pillar of the great, you know, enduring the suffering and returning to tell about it. And, of course, Amundsen's entire career after that was devoted to, and he specifically mentions it, and there's plenty of evidence to show that this is exactly what he worked towards. He actually worked towards avoiding all types of suffering, all disasters, by taking precautions to avoid them. So, yeah, it's interesting sides to his personality. On the one hand, he idolized the suffering and disaster and wanted to be part of it, and yet, you know, for decades, his entire career was devoted to taking as many precautions as he could to avoid unnecessary suffering and only come back successful. And, of course, he was enormously successful.
Yes. And it's interesting how his whole hardening process really did lend itself to the preparation that he needed throughout his entire career as an explorer. And you wrote about a trip that he took with his brother that was really profound as far as his decisions that he made later on in life and what he chose to do as far as preparing for any trip that he would take. Can you just share that story with our audience? Because I think that that was a very important journey that he took with his brother.
Yeah, I mean, essentially what they did was they went to a remote area near Christiania, which is what Oslo used to be called, and they were going to ski across a remote and famous plateau in the winter, something which hadn't been done before. And, you know, being youthful and, you know, that standard youthful feeling of invincibility that people sometimes have, they set off. They were completely unprepared for this adventure. They didn't have proper food. They didn't bring tents because they didn't want to carry them. They hadn't even done very much, you know, they hadn't even done a great deal of training. And, of course, skiing technology was in its infancy back then, too. It was just newly being developed as a sport in Norway. So their equipment wasn't the best either. And, of course, it was a near disaster. They almost died. But for Amundsen, nearly freezing to death in a snowstorm, completely lost on that plateau, you know, he took that as a great learning thing. He vowed that never again would he ever set off completely unprepared on an expedition like that. And of course, he never did. I mean, he took the most incredible precautions to avoid disasters. He had every last, you know, his famous rush to the South Pole. The level of detail that he had planned for food on that trip is just, it's something which is stunning in its complexity. He had variations on how much food each person and each dog would eat on each day of the journey and how long their equipment would be expected to last. And he had this all planned out in detailed sheets of paper and worked out for different variables for it, what the climate was likely to be, what the variation was. And he had, you know, he planned down to minute detail so that when they arrived in the South Pole, they had all this equipment, exactly what they needed, no more, no less. They had the trip planned out. I think he returned within 2 days of his actual plannings on how long it was going to take them to do this journey. And they returned with precisely the amount of food that they thought they were going to eat. And a certain number of dogs had died, and that was within his margin of error. Like the amount of detail that he put into planning things was incredible. And it stems directly from that failed expedition where nothing was planned, and it was just a slapdash rush across the plateau. So it was a very, yeah, I think he learned a lot from that. And, you know, of course, a lot of people might have just died on an expedition like that, but he had the good fortune of surviving that in order to learn from his mistakes.
Can you share with our audience exactly what the rations were and also the clothing? Because I think the clothing was very important, especially as opposed to what Robert Scott's team were equipped with the clothing that they were wearing, rather.
Yeah, I mean, that's a really important distinction to make, is that Amundsen had the benefit. Now, of course, we're jumping in time a little bit here. We're not talking about his expedition across the plateau as a youth anymore. We're talking about the Antarctic expedition.
Yeah.
But on this Antarctic expedition, he was so successful because he had an expansive imagination. He was able to take information that he learned from any source that was available to him and apply it to his situation. And the great bit of information that he learned, I think, is that the years he spent living with the Inuit in the Arctic, in the Northwest Passage, mm-hmm. the 3 years that he was there, he was very open-minded for the era, and he didn't look down on these people who were living there and saying, oh, those are primitive savages. They have nothing to teach me. He looked and said, these are the masters of polar survival. Here they are, technically, in what he would call the middle of nowhere, and yet they go on living. They're not just on an expedition. They're not dashing in and dashing out. Their entire lives were spent living there. So Amundsen was able to say, I'm going to take what I can, learn from all of these people, and use that knowledge. And what he got from them was specifically how to treat and raise these sort of semi-feral beasts that were the pack animals, the dogs, how to feed them, how to train them, how to take care of them. He learned the clothing design of the Inuit, specifically what to wear as underclothing, how tight the clothing should be, the design and cut of it, and how low it should go for proper movement, and of course the material to be used, the certain types of skins prepared in a certain type of way with the fur facing a different direction. And of course he learned how to prevent scurvy by eating certain fresh meats, particularly seal meats. And of course all of that type of knowledge he took with him to the South Pole. And you know, he was incredibly successful, as opposed to Scott, for example, who, you know, he set off to be the explorer of the South Pole as a British explorer, and he wanted to be seen to be doing it the British way, with no. And now, you know, it's hard to say what Scott would have done if he wasn't essentially a very public agent of the British Empire at that time. I mean,
you don't think that Scott was driven by ego? I mean, he seemed to be such an arrogant individual, which is ironic because that's how many people perceived Amundsen to be. And from what I was able to take from The Last Viking was that the way that you depicted Amundsen was that Amundsen was truly a great outdoorsman, but he was also a great leader, because he had respect for his team. He didn't put the I, so to speak, in the word team. He embraced his team, and he would do anything for his team. And that was evident, especially since, even though some people complained because his personality, his disposition was really kind of difficult, they still continued to sign up for future expeditions.
Yeah, it's very interesting.
The testimony, you know, to why he was so great.
Yeah, he had great respect from his, you know, the expedition people who went with him years and years. Lots of people kept signing on again and again. They knew that he was going to be, you know, even if he was, they couldn't immediately see, why are we doing all this? Why are we shaving an extra quarter inch off of our sleds? And why are we wasting all our time on this? But he was always successful, and none of his people ever died, really. And, you know, I was, in a sense there, I was just trying to give the benefit of the doubt to Scott, because I don't want to say anything, you know, especially negative towards him as an individual or a person, because I haven't really, you know, I haven't written the biography of Scott at all, and I tried to stray away from making comparisons between the two, which is so often done, and you get into that little conflict, oh, Amundsen was great, no, Scott was the best, and it's back and forth, and I don't think there's very much to learn from that anymore. We've already been through that, it's all been done. I was more trying to point out that as the representative of the British Empire, Scott, even if he may have had the latitude in thinking to incorporate, you know, indigenous technology in his quest for, you know, reaching the South Pole, even if he was the type of person who would have done that, he wouldn't have been able to do that anyway because of his role as the figurehead for an empire. He had to be seen to be doing it in the manner that empire, with the technology of that empire, in the way that empire positioned itself in the world at that time. So he was using British technology. They wanted to be wearing, you know, wool things. They were taking ponies instead of dogs. Their food was tinned and packaged in manufacturing, you know, places in Britain. It wasn't, they weren't going there to live off the land or to try and use, you know, indigenous survival techniques.
It was basically a quest, but I think that's as someone who has tried to just absorb all the different things that you brought in The Last Viking about Amundsen, what I found was that it enabled me to really appreciate the fact that Amundsen embraced the land. He had respect for the land. It wasn't just an order. It wasn't a position that he was responsible for. He did it because he got it. he really understood and connected with nature. And even his choice of having dogs, I mean, that's what I took away from it. And just the fact that he chose to work with dogs as opposed to ponies was also something significant. Can you talk about that particular choice, why he chose dogs, why he made some of the decisions that he did as far as his gear?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think you're absolutely right that Amundsen did have a great respect for the land, a great love for the land and the wild regions. I mean, he devoted his entire life to getting back to those places as much as he possibly could, with the raw power of nature was always exposed in those extreme environments like that. And, you know, that's where his great love was for, and that's where he kept wanting to position himself. And having the respect for the land, he didn't set out to conquer it and defeat it. He wanted to find whatever method he could to work his way through it. And, you know, once again, I think we already mentioned this, he took knowledge from wherever he could get it, and particularly from the indigenous technology of the Inuit. And with the dogs, I mean, he saw when he was up there for those years living in the Arctic that the dogs were living there. These particular breed of dogs were exceedingly tough. They were exceedingly, they would eat just raw frozen food is what they survived on. The dogs would even eat each other, and that was just it seems very off-putting.
Barbaric.
Yeah, barbaric and crude, and yet that's the way that life was in those areas, particularly at that time. The dogs would actually eat each other. If one of them was weak and died, the other ones would pounce on it and devour it. I mean, in a quest for calories, essentially. But Amundsen learned how to use those dogs in the way that the Inuit used them, as, codependent survivors in a harsh environment. He knew that you couldn't just, take a pony and put it there. It would just freeze to death, which is, of course, exactly what happened with the dogs. You know, their paws would spread out so they didn't sink in the snow. Their fur kept them cold, even in minus, 30 degree temperatures. They were suited and adapted to that environment, and Antarctica is not all that different from the Arctic when it comes to the cold and the extreme ice and these environments that he lived in. And more than anything else, it was the dogs that enabled that success at the South Pole, because the dogs, were pulling all the sleds, and Scott had the British men pulling the sleds, which is what broke down their strength and caused them to weaken and suffer. I mean, you can't really pull that much weight. I mean, it's important to point out, some people today, when they're doing explorations in the Arctic or racing towards Ellesmere Island or the South Pole, I mean, they can pull their own sleds. But with technology being so different now, I think these modern sleds weigh as much fully loaded with weeks and weeks of food as sleds in Amundsen's era weighed when they were completely empty. So, it's not really a direct comparison. So people can go on, people can haul their own sleds now. Back then, they had hundreds and hundreds of pounds of weight, and it just broke down the men and killed them, essentially. Whereas when the dogs were doing it, I mean, you have a whole team of, 6 to 10 dogs pulling each sled, and you just ski along beside them. They didn't ride on the sleds; they skied beside them. And that's one of the great keys to their success. Well, he saw the Inuit. They lived like that. That's how they did their hunting. That's how they did their traveling. And he just copied it. Use that knowledge into a different environment.
And I think, once again, that just demonstrates that he truly had respect for the land and for nature, because he was able to work with it instead of working against it and trying to will it for his own needs.
Yeah, and he loved it, too. Yeah.
Yeah, he was like a kid in a candy shop with every adventure. I mean, can you just share with our audience about just when he began this expedition? How old was he?
He was probably, when he was racing towards the South Pole, he was in his late 30s. So he was, he was mature in the sense that he'd already been on one expedition to Antarctica before that, a Belgian expedition, which was a bit of a disaster, but it also wasn't a learning experience for him, and he did that in his late 20s. And then he went in his early 30s to mid-30s. He was navigating the Northwest Passage and, of course, learning everything that he could from the Inuit up there and sailing the ship through down from, Baffin Island down to Alaska. And then, so by the late 30s, he was ready for his South Polar dash. And all the the crew who were with him on that expedition were all around the same age, late 30s, early 40s for most of them. And so they were, you know, they weren't in the rash phase of youth. They were, you know, they were still in the, you know, at the peak of their strength and endurance, but they had a bit more maturity and they were able to make better decisions, I think, because of that.
Can you share with our audience what happened when they reached the actual South Pole? What did they leave behind?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's interesting. I mean, the South Pole, you know, it's not a, I mean, it's a place, but it's not, there's nothing there. It's, you know, the chapter in my book, I just call it a featureless expanse of snow, and that's really what it was. I mean, they had to have scientific instruments to sort of position themselves, and they went back and forth in the grid so that they could, you know, plant a flag in a small little tent, and that was the only, it was the only evidence that they had ever been there, because there is no, there's nothing at the South Pole back then. It was just nothing. And so, yeah, they spent days traversing back and forth across this grid of land, marking every last bit of it, and trying to measure as close as they possibly could to say that they were there, so that they wouldn't get all the way out and someone said, oh, no, you missed it.
Mm.
You know, you were 2 miles off. You weren't the first person to get to the South Pole. After all that effort, they wanted to really make sure that they, you know, actually were there. And so after several days of work, they planted a flag and built a small tent, had a little ceremony, they slept there. They were all bone weary and exhausted. There wasn't much to it. They didn't have too much food left. A lot of the dogs had died by then. They were quiet. I think they shared a pipe of tobacco and ate a last little tiny bit of chocolate that they had saved, and then they started back. That was it.
It's interesting. There's a famous picture of that moment, and I think you could Google it, where he is standing with his team. And it's interesting. He's the person that is, I guess, behind the team. His team, the men on his team are standing in front of him. And to me, that symbolizes his true disposition, someone who not only was a leader, but he genuinely cared about his team. And instead of being the first one, you know, closest to that point, he was actually behind them, almost like a father, if you will.
Yeah, he was overseeing the thing. And you're right that he was very much part of a team. He viewed himself as, I don't know if first among equals is the right term, but, you know, he was definitely the leader. But he was not that he wasn't trying to claim all the fame for himself. When they went to plant that flag into the South Pole, he made sure that everyone's hand was on the flag before they stuck it into the snow, in a full recognition that it wasn't one person who got to the South Pole. It was all of us got there, and you know, everyone, he got the most recognition for it. But everyone talks about Amundsen's expedition because he was the one who organized it. But he never ever pretended that he would have accomplished anything without the extremely talented people that went with him. And he was someone who, in other people, he did not recognize. He did not look for people who would just do what he told them to do. He looked for extremely competent people in their area of knowledge, and he picked the best people that he could, people who knew more than him on almost every single aspect of the expedition. So he was not really the best at anything. He wasn't the best skier. He wasn't the best dog driver. He wasn't the best at navigation. He wasn't the best at anything. But he brought them together as a team, and all these people had their individual skills, you know, working towards this common objective and the common goal. And he kept everyone focused on the goal and had everything planned for it. But he definitely was not the greatest in expertise in any area at all. And so that's very interesting, too, because it takes a lot of confidence in your own abilities, I think, as a leader. There's, you know, to pick people who are better than you for your areas and try and recruit them into your objective, as opposed to getting people who are obviously subservient towards you and who will listen to whatever you say. And there's two different types of leadership there.
And I think his leadership was really what made all the difference, especially with the success of his expedition and his other travels. I mean, he truly demonstrated what it means to be a leader. Stephen, we are out of time. Thank you so much for coming on the show today. Can you share with our audience your website? And also, do you have any upcoming lectures or any events that you'd like to share with our audience?
Well, I don't have any particular events coming in the near future. I've been doing a lot of talking so far, and a lot of it's kind of passed already. But I will give you my website and a Facebook page. My web is www.stephenrbown.net. And on Facebook, it's www.facebook.com/srbown. And on the Facebook page, you don't have to be a member of Facebook to go on there, but I put frequent updates up about interesting little information that I've received from people, or some people have sent me some photographs, or you know, any new developments in relation to The Last Viking. My book is up on that page now.
Thank you so much. And do you have anything that you'd like to share with our audience as far as any projects that you're working on in the future?
Well, you know, I have started to work a little bit on a book that I'm tentatively titling In the Kingdom of the North Wind. And it would be looking at, you know, a famous Danish ethnographer and poet named Knud Rasmussen, who around the same era as Amundsen. He was up in the Arctic all the way from Alaska to Greenland, interviewing all the Inuit people who lived up there and recording all of their unusual and brooding poetry and stories and folklore. And he compiled it all into these, you know, this huge volume of books. But I mean, he's not very well known right now because, you know, he's just been lost a bit. But he's an incredible adventurous life, and his literary achievement is second to none in the whole world. So I'm really looking at that right now.
Well, that is one book that I am looking forward to reading, and also having you come back on the show and sharing your work with our audience. Stephen, thank you so much for coming on the show. And folks, thank you for tuning in today. And please pick up a copy of Stephen's book, The Last Viking, The Life of Roald Amundsen. It's available where all books are sold, and please also visit his website. Thank you, everyone, for tuning in. This has been June Stoyer with the Organic View Radio Show. Have a great afternoon, everyone.